So turn with me, if you would, to Hebrews chapter 10. We will focus on that chapter today. And then I want to bring some material from a book that has come out by an individual that is fairly well known for those of you that love all these crime scene kinds of stories. If you ever watched Cold Case or Dateline, J. Werner Wallace, you probably have seen him before. As a matter of fact, Keith Morrison, who's the news correspondent for Dateline, said, around Dateline, we had a phrase to describe J. Werner Wallace, the evidence whisperer. And he's actually been able to crack some of these cold cases. And he then, a number of years ago, became a Christian. And so first came out with a book called Cold Case Christianity, this latest one, God's Crime Scene. And I think you'll really enjoy that. And I have an interview that I did with him, in case you'd like to listen to that as you're driving around Dallas this week. So lots of things to cover, and we'll get into it by focusing, first of all, on Hebrews chapter 10. We see, as we have gone through here, that animal sacrifices could not perfect the sinner, but Christ's superior sacrifice did. And so today we're going to look at Jesus as a better purifier. You've ever had a water purifier, an air purifier? Well, we're talking about purifier from sin. And worshipers have been purified by the blood of Christ and are empowered in mind and heart to encourage one another in this new covenant that we live in. And so we're going to spend some time breaking this chapter into two sections. We're going to look at the first 18 verses. So follow me as we go along. For since the law has but a shadow of the good things to come instead of the true form of these realities, it can never, by the same sacrifices that are continually offered every year, make perfect those who draw near. Otherwise, would they not have ceased to be offered, since the worshippers, having been once cleansed, would no longer have any consciousness of sin? But in these sacrifices there is a reminder of sins every year, for it is impossible for the blood of bulls and goats to take away sins. Perhaps the most famous verse in this chapter. Verse 5, consequently, when Christ came into the world, he said, sacrifices and offerings you have not desired, but a body have you prepared for me. In burnt offerings and sin offerings you have taken no pleasure. Then I said, behold, I have come to do your will, O God, as it is written of me in the scroll of the book. Verse 8. When he said above, you have neither desired nor taken pleasure in sacrifices and offerings and burnt offerings and in sin offerings, these are offered according to the law. Then he added, behold, I have come to do your will. He does away with the first in order to establish the second. And by that we have been sacrificed through the offering of the body of Jesus Christ once for all. And every priest stands daily at his service, offering repeatedly the same sacrifices, which can never take away sins. But when Christ has offered for all time the single sacrifice for sins, he sat down at the right hand of God, waiting from the time until his enemies should be made the footstool at his feet. For by a single offering he has perfected for all time those who are being sacrificed. And the Holy Spirit also bears witness to us, for after saying, this is the covenant that I make with them, after those days, declares the Lord, I will put my laws on their hearts and write them on their minds. And then he adds, I will remember their sins and their lawless deeds no more. Another very famous verse in this chapter. Where there is forgiveness of these, there is no longer any offering for sin. Quite a lot covered there, but we'll try to see if we can sort some of that out and recognize that, first of all, he is talking about the permanence of Christ's sacrifice compared to the impermanence of what happened in the Old Testament. And we're going to see a number of reasons for that idea of permanence. The first is permanence in contrast to the Old Testament sacrifices, because the Old Testament sacrifices were part of the tradition. Today, Jared talked about, for example, waiting 400 years of silence or waiting 700 years. He did a lot on waiting today. It's going to hopefully make us more patient. But you think about that 700 years of tradition that is taking place. He is now writing, the writer is writing to those who have been so steeped in that tradition. Some of them are even thinking of leaving Christianity and going back to Judaism, which is one of the reasons why this epistle was written. But these sacrifices could only remind them of sin. It could not remove sin. And so he is pointing out, first of all, the permanence in contrast to the Old Testament sacrifices. And then in verse 2, he asks a question, sort of a rhetorical question, and it's this. If the offering made by worshipers in the past was perfect, wouldn't they no longer have any consciousness of sin? In other words, if the Old Testament sacrifices were enough, then everybody would go along and say, hey, I'm free from sin. But the point is that every sacrifice and every time the priest came into the holy place, it was a reminder of their sin. And of course, then, as I mentioned, one of the most famous verses in chapter 10 is verse 4. It is impossible for the blood of bulls and goats to take away sin. And to this day, there are those in the Jewish tradition that are hoping to establish a temple in Jerusalem, establish the Old Testament sacrifices. But what they will find is all those sacrifices do is remind you of sin. They don't remove sin, because the blood of bulls and goats will not actually take away sin. So we see permanence in terms of the Old Testament. We see permanence, number two, in terms of obedience. You can follow along in the outline there. By the way, I might just mention, for those of you that are new to the class, at the bottom of that outline, you will notice it says PrestonWoodExamined.org. And Parker today took this outline and put it there, so you can follow along or go back later and study it if you'd like. And here now, this is a quote from Psalm chapter 40, and it explains, in a sense, why Christ came into the world. I suspect next week, this will be one of the psalms that either Pastor Graham or Jarrett Stevens will quote as we go through our three-week series here on the coming of Christ. And it is a very important one, because here the author of Hebrews ties Psalm 40 together with the New Testament, because it helps us understand that Christ willingly submitted his life to the plan of God. And then he began, because of perfect obedience to Christ's will, then we are sanctified through him. When Jesus looks at us, he looks through his Son, who is perfect. And because of that obedience, then there's permanence, not only because it is no longer required in the Old Testament, but it's also, again, permanent because of the obedience of Christ. And then the third point is, it's permanence because it secures forgiveness of sins. And the sacrifice lasted because it offered a permanent pardon. You know, Christ doesn't have to come back again and die again. Christ doesn't come back again. When Christ returns, he's not coming to actually pardon us from sin. Christ is going to come that we might live in this new heaven and new earth. By contrast, of course, then the priest stands at daily service, waiting each day to do these sacrifices. And the contrast is in verse 12. You can see in verse 12 it says that he sat down. Now, you're probably grateful that you're sitting down right now. I know those of us that were, those of you in the choir, for sure, you're glad you're sitting down, right? Because they've been doing nothing but standing for the three services and, 10 more coming, you know? Or even sometimes when we're doing the worship service here, you know, with the hand signals, you know, we just heard about, you know, sometimes we're saying, I'm ready to sit down, you know? But the idea of sitting down in the Old Testament was you sat down when your work is finished. So here's the contrast between the priest who stood. There's no place to stand in the temple. There's no place to stand in the tabernacle. You're sort of on duty. But here, Jesus has perfected all that he needed to do, and he has sat down. And so now, verse 13, we're waiting for the time when Christ returns in victory. And this is put in maybe a way that doesn't make sense, but it's the concept here where the enemy should be made as a footstool. They're kind of at the feet of Jesus. And so they're looking for a time of a defeat of the enemies. You can imagine how they would feel, because as we're going to see in just a minute, he reminds them of a time and when they were persecuted and when they lost their possessions. Imagine if somebody came into your house and just started stripping things out because you were being persecuted. And think of those individuals we've talked about in the past that were Iraqi Christians that had to escape with nothing because it was taken over by ISIS. And here, the idea that these enemies, which loom very large right now for these persecuted Christians, will eventually be just a footstool at the feet of Jesus. And then, of course, it reminds us of the Holy Spirit. And then we see this quote from Jeremiah 31, which again shows us these three different aspects of why the sacrifice of Jesus is permanent. Let's, if we can, now go on to finish this chapter. Start with me in verse 19. Therefore, brothers, since we have confidence to enter the holy places by the blood of Jesus, by the new and living way that he opened for us through the curtain, that is, through his flesh. And since we have a great priest over the house of God, let us draw near with the true heart in full assurance of faith, with our hearts sprinkled clean from an evil conscience and our bodies washed with pure water. Let us hold fast the confession of our hope without wavering, for he who promised is faithful. And let us consider how to stir up one another to love and good works, not neglecting to meet together as is the habit of some, but encouraging one another and all the more as you see the day drawing near. For if we go on sinning deliberately after receiving the knowledge of the truth, there is no longer remains a sacrifice for sins, but a fearful expectation of judgment and a fury of fire that will consume the adversaries. Anyone who has set aside the law of Moses dies without mercy on the evidence of two or three witnesses. How much worse punishment do you think will be deserved by one who has spurned the Son of God and has profaned the blood of the covenant by which he was sanctified and has outraged the Spirit of grace? For we know him who said, "Vengeance is mine, I will repay," and again, "The Lord will judge his people." It is a fearful thing to fall into the hands of the living God. But recall the former days when, after you were enlightened, you endured a hard struggle with sufferings, sometimes being publicly exposed to reproach and affliction, and sometimes being partners with those so treated. And for you had compassion for those in prison, and you joyfully accepted the plundering of your property, since you knew that you yourselves had a better possession and abiding one. Therefore, do not throw away your confidence, which has a great reward, for you have need of endurance, so that when you have done the will of God, you may receive what is promised. For yet a little while, and the coming one will come and will not delay, but my righteous one shall live by faith. If he shrinks back, my soul has no pleasure in him. But we are not of those who shrink back and are destroyed, but of those who have faith and preserve their souls. And so once again, we see the emphasis here upon not only the promise of Christ's sacrifice, but now his power. And really, it's an appeal to the power of Jesus. In light of what we just learned, we sort of have the so what section of this chapter. So often the author will say, here's what we believe, and now here is how we are to act. We know what we believe, and that is Jesus is a perfect sacrifice. Now, because of that, we should draw near to Jesus with a full assurance of faith. We can approach God because of the blood of Jesus. And again, this may be something, as many of us have been Christians for a long time, we take for granted. But imagine how a Jewish individual, as I think Jared reminds us, who wonders if they are right with God. He went into today to talk about the fact that if you lived in the Galilee, you probably were poor and probably had no way to actually go to a temple and offer sacrifices. At best, maybe you could go to a local synagogue. And so you had no possibility of being able to approach God. And now the good news is that you can approach God, and you can approach God with confidence. That is amazing. Then it talks about the curtain, and I believe that that is the curtain that he's describing, which was the curtain that divided the holy place from the most holy place, or sometimes your translations will call it the Holy of Holies. What happened after Christ was crucified? The curtain ripped apart. And so here he uses this idea of the curtain, and now opens up a new way to God. Whereas before, the only way to God, which was sort of with your fingers crossed, was through an animal sacrifice that you hope during the Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, maybe God would at least once away cover over the sins. But now it is the idea that we can approach God with mercy and grace through our great high priest, who is Jesus Christ. Then we see some aspects of Christ's power. If you're taking some notes, it's kind of 1, 2, 3, 4. But first of all, it shows how do we approach God. And first of all, it says we are to come with a true heart. And so again, oftentimes we can remind ourselves in the Psalms and Proverbs, it talks about guarding your heart. So really, make sure that you have a true heart as you approach God. Number two, we can come with a full assurance of faith. There's that confidence part. So again, with any kind of pure heart, you could put, if you want to make it a C, conviction, that we no longer have conviction of sin. Number two, now we have what? Confidence. We can approach God in that way. Well, the next one, we see an evil conscience. This is the third part, that we have our hearts sprinkled from an evil conscience. Or sometimes, if you want a different C, some of your translations say an evil confession. Depends on whether you have New American Standard, NIV, or English Standard Version, but they're all basically saying the same idea, that our hearts are sprinkled from that. And then finally, we're to have our bodies washed with a pure water, baptism. Sometimes we have our good friends that go to different churches where they sprinkle for baptism. But notice what you sprinkle. You sprinkle the hearts. But when it comes to the body, what do? We wash the bodies, you know. There's a pretty good argument here, again, for immersion, even in this passage and certainly many others. But again, it illustrates again, because of Christ's power and because of what he has done, we can approach Christ, we can approach God with pure confidence and a pure heart. We're also interesting enough to hold fast to our confession, another one of those C's in our list, and to consider how to encourage one another to good works. And I think this is kind of intriguing that this was written, because as we sort of sense from this, apparently there were some that no longer felt that it was important to go to church. Or to go and gather with other believers. In some respects, the church was just a gathering of individuals in a home church. But it was very important. And if you think about this, this is one of those verses. For those of you that ever memorized the Navigator scripture memory, I remember oftentimes when I was working for Pacific Gas and Electric and digging ditches and things like that, I had a lot of free time, so it was a great way to memorize verses. This week when I had O.S. Hawkins in studio, he was talking about the first verse he memorized, which is the first verse I memorized, interestingly enough, but his was a little different. I at least had gone to a very liberal church, became a Christian, and actually went to a more evangelical church. But he actually memorized this verse after only going to church in Fort Worth for the very first time. And somebody said, young man, this is a verse that you need to know. And it said 1 Cor 10:13. He didn't know what in the world that meant. He went out and bought a Bible. And when he got the Bible, he'd never been to church before, he looked through it and he saw, oh, C-O-R, that stands for Corinthians. So, okay, I guess that's there. 10, maybe that's the chapter. And then he found the verse and he memorized right there, there's no temptations overtaken you. And well, that was one of those verses. But one of the other ones is this one. And that is to not neglecting the gathering together of some. And that was really helpful, I think, for all of us that were memorizing that verse, because you sort of had this Jesus movement philosophy that said, well, you know, I can worship God out here and I can worship God in the and all the rest. And then you're around a lot of people. You know, you've heard all the phrases about the bedside Baptists, you know, Baptists that say, well, I'll just stay in bed. And besides, now with this, I can actually just on my smartphone listen to Jarrett Stevens. I don't even have to get dressed, right? You know, Church of the Inner Springs, I got everything I need right here, you know. And so this, again, reminds us that we are to actually to meet together with other believers. And so this was a problem in the first century. Interesting, it's also the problem here in the 21st century. It's again a very important verse to remind us that we need to be together with one another. Then we come to one of these warning passages. Since I covered this before, when we came through Hebrews chapter 6 and 7, you might want to go look back, because what you have is a reiteration here in chapter 10 of some of the warnings that were given in chapter 6. But it's a warning against God's judgment. And here it's again the concern about those individuals who have accepted the grace and accepted the free gift of salvation, but then particularly head on and live, in some cases, a sinful life. Or in the case of some that I believe he was writing to, actually were thinking of leaving Christianity and going back to Judaism. Because after all, the Jewish traditions, it's very easy. You knew you had to follow these particular regulations and these particular commandments. It was very clear, very simple, very legalistic. And as hard as it is for us to imagine how somebody would want to leave the gospel and go back to the law, that was another challenge. And again, it's a warning against those who wanted to do so. And then in the midst of this, even after that condemnation, you have a commendation for those who persevere. And these verses are actually encouraging them to remember the days after their conversion when they stood their ground. These were individuals who publicly professed Jesus Christ. Most of them probably were publicly baptized, and at that point might have been shunned by their family, shunned by people in their community, but they stood their ground in the midst of that persecution. And yet it says that they had compassion for those who were in prison, those who actually suffered for their faith, and also accepted the loss of their possessions. Now just think about what that was like. They probably had very little. But imagine somebody coming in and just ransacking your home and having even less. But to recognize, my world is not with these possessions. My possession is in heaven. And here we see again a reminder of them to actually persevere. And then in verse 5, don't throw away the confidence you once had. There was a time in which you had confidence. Now you've begun to waver a little bit. And he's saying again, you need perseverance to endure the hardships that you are now facing. And this is a word for all of us, but especially for believers around the world that face those kind of persecution and hardships every single day. I hope you're praying for them. And then we have again a quote from Isaiah, Isaiah 26 verse 20, another encouragement for them to endure. And so again, we end with this emphasis upon the fact that we have enjoyed a perfection. Not because we're perfect, but because Jesus was perfect. We enjoy a pardon, not because we deserved a pardon, but because he pardoned us. And we have access to God because we have a great high priest. So if nothing else, I would hope that this would be an encouragement to you as we look at the book of Hebrews. And I thought for just a few minutes, let's, if we can, talk about this new book. And it is entitled God's Crime Scene. G. Warner Wallace is one of these rising stars right now in the area of apologetics. And you may have seen him. I got prematurely gray hair, and so for all the world, he looks a lot like Anderson Cooper. So if you see a guy on Christian television that looks like Anderson Cooper and is incredibly gifted, he was here recently speaking at the University of Texas at Dallas, and everybody just remarked at how incredible his slide presentations were. I'd like to see if I could get a hold of those, because he has also had a background in graphic arts, and apparently he's just done a phenomenal job in presenting some of that. If I could ever figure out a way to get him into the class here for a Sunday, I think you would really enjoy it. And after you go through some of this in the next couple of minutes, I think you'll see why. Because again, here is an individual who was a cold case homicide detective, still works in that profession, and is one that has broken a number of these cases. If you type in like J. Warner Wallace and Dateline, you can go watch some of the clips and say, you know, this guy's pretty amazing in what he's been able to do. So he's taken all the training that he's had on how to break these cold cases and applied it now to things like the Bible. And this particular one looks at, do we have evidence for a divinely created universe? Now here, let me have you follow through this real quickly. What he says is you have to ask yourself when you have a crime scene, can I explain everything inside the room or do I need to go outside the room? Let's say you are an investigator like he is, and he talks about in here actual cases that where he broke the cases. You go into a room and you see somebody has shot themselves, you think. And then you see that the particular person in that room owned that gun. You see that there's nothing that's disturbed. There's no forced entry. There's a suicide note. And you can explain then what happened inside the room, inside the room. But if you go into another room and you see that the individual, that there is a weapon and it's not that individual, that you maybe have footprints of individual from mud, you might have fingerprints or DNA from another, at that point you look outside the room. Does that make sense? Now, if you understand this, now you're going to understand what I'm going to take you through for the next 20 minutes, okay? Because what he says is when we look at, if you will, God's crime scene, can we explain everything we see in the universe by the universe? And so we're going to look at different kinds of things that are outside of that. For example, the beginning of the universe, the fine-tuning of the universe, the issue of biology, even the questions of God and evil and moral standard and consciousness and all that. Can we explain that inside the room? Our atheist friends, which is Richard Dawkins or Sam Harris or when he was alive Christopher Hitchens or Daniel Dennett or all sorts of other individuals like that, say we can explain the universe while we don't have to appeal to anything outside. And what he says is if you use this kind of crime scene investigation, you can very quickly explain that we need something outside of the universe. So let's take the first one in one of his chapters, and you can see it follow along in the notes here. In the beginning, was the universe an inside job? In other words, can we explain the universe by itself? There have been a lot of people that said, well, the universe just came from another universe. But that's the problem of an infinite regress. There used to be a time in the ancient world where they believed that the world, that is the earth, rested on the back of a turtle. But then someone asked, well, then what did the turtle rest on? Well, another turtle. Well, then what did that turtle rest on? Another turtle. And eventually there came to be an Inus. Turtles all the way down. Well, that's an infinite regress. That doesn't make any sense. And so as a result, what he points out is that now the evidence from mathematics, from physics, and astronomy all say that the universe had a beginning. You can look at the expanding universe. We can see the light coming from stars, and it shifted to the red spectrum, and you can see the universe is getting bigger, and that suggests a time when it was all together. Second law of thermodynamics says that things are running downhill. It's like a clock that's been wound up, but there's a time when somebody was doing the winding up. And so as a result, the universe had a beginning. Now, you can do some calculations as well in terms of mathematics, and I won't take you through that chapter, to argue that that origin of that universe actually had to have some cause that was outside of it. And so it's reasonable to believe that a universe had a beginning, and the universe came into being from something that was beyond space, time, matter, and energy. Does that make sense? The cause has to be bigger than that, right? You have to certainly understand that. And it could not have had no cause, because after all, that's an infinite regress. So as a result, he begins to say, you know, we are starting to begin to have a profile of the suspect that might have brought this into being. And the suspect should be external to the universe, non-spatial, because something outside of space created space, atemporal, outside of time that created time, and non-material, outside of matter, uncaused, and powerful enough to create the universe. That makes sense? You starting to see what possible candidates are? Okay, and again, I've gone through a long chapter in a very short amount of time, but let's take something else then. Because then he talks about these layers of evidence. We have the foundational fine-tuning. And if you go to our website, pointofview.net, you could be able to read this a little bit more. But I've taken certain sections out of his book to illustrate this as well. And that is, as you start looking at the ratio between, like, the proton and the electron, the fine-tuning of the electromagnetic force. If we look at the fine-tuning of the various atoms and the fine-tuning of the universe, you recognize that when we just look at the universe itself, it's really fine-tuned. And notice he has little dials there, and each one of those dials are so finely calibrated. As you say, if you move the dial a little bit to the left, or a little bit to the right, you don't have a universe. So when we look at some of the layers of evidence, you're beginning to see that there's a foundational fine-tuning. Then there's a regional fine-tuning. Had to have a little astronomy here for Parker, if nothing else. And that is, you know, when we look at where we are in the galaxy, we're in the right galaxy. We're in the right place in the galaxy. We're in the right distance from some of the dangerous parts of the galaxy. We're in a place where we can observe other planets and other galaxies. And all of those particular parameters are what? Just right. Then you even look at our locational fine-tuning. As we've pointed out in this class before, the Earth is just where it needs to be in terms of the sun. First of all, we have the right kind of sun that burns just very well. But also, if we were even just 5% closer to the sun, we would run into all sorts of difficulties and have a runaway greenhouse effect, and life on this planet would be impossible. If we were just 20% further away, we would begin to freeze up things. And again, complex life would not be possible. The angle and tilt of the Earth, the size of our moon, and all of this are just right. So again, these layers of evidence begin to give us something else about this suspect, because we find that that suspect needs to be external to the universe, non-spatial, atemporal, non-material, uncaused, powerful enough to create the universe, and now one more point, purposeful enough to produce a universe fine-tuned for life. Then we look at the issue of the origin of life. And here you run into all sorts of problems that scientists are working with, because you deal with the complexity of life at the cell. Charles Darwin had no idea in the 19th century how complex life was, because when you look with a light microscope, if you ever looked at a paramecium or an amoeba or something like that, this looks like a bag of goo. They even called it protoplasm. But now electron microscopes have helped us to understand how complex life is at the cellular level, and what it takes, for example, to form amino acids that form proteins, what it takes to form nucleic bases that give you your DNA, and the whole formation of that is a difficulty. And one of the things scientists are dealing with is kind of a catch-22. because proteins are required to create ribosomes, but ribosomes are needed to create proteins. You get kind of this catch-22, which is very difficult. And so again, as we begin to look at the complexity of life, we see maybe one more indication of that. We also see that as we look at design, as we look at these cellular levels, one of those is this little bacterial flagellum, which is found in E. coli cells, which are in your body and found other places. And we recognize this is a diagram of that motor. It's a cellular motor, and it looks a little bit like a motor that you would make in a machine shop, doesn't it? And again, so we're seeing levels of design. There are over 100 to almost 200 different of these molecular motors at the cellular level that people would never have recognized were there. But now in the 21st century, we're recognizing now how much more complex life is. So that begins to build our profile of our suspect a little bit more, who's external to the universe, non-spatial, atemporal, non-material, uncaused, powerful enough to create the universe, and as we mentioned just a minute ago, purposeful enough to produce a universe fine-tuned for life, but also what? Intelligent, and then creative. You got to believe God has a sense of humor when you look at a platypus, right? You know, when you look at a giraffe and some other creatures, just incredibly creative. And of course, we've gone through some of this with our Institute for Creation research material, but this is just looking at it one more place. Now we had some things that we haven't talked about with the ICR, but these are kind of interesting, and that is the whole issue of consciousness. And this begins to give us evidence of God's crime scene as well. Because the atheists will tell us that you really don't have a mind. You just have a brain. Well, your brain is there, but there is something acting on your brain. Your brain is like a computer, but who's at the terminal giving it some direction? You know, and this is, I think, why we see today more and more scientists are saying there seems to be something more to the brain than just the brain, and that is a mind. Because the brain can be publicly accessed. I can hook up electrodes and I can see whether or not you are asleep, as some of you are right now, or you're angry, or whether you're confused, as some of you may be as well. And as well, I could find out all sorts of things about your mental state. But if you were angry, I couldn't tell why you're angry. I could tell that you were angry. If you're dozing, I could tell you're dozing, but I can't even tell what you're dreaming about. There's something else going on about that. And that's the thing. The brain is publicly accessed. The mind is privately accessed. The brain is impersonal. The mind is personal. The brain is objective. The mind is subjective, able to make choices. The brain is measurable. The mind is measureless. And I love what he points out here is that if you look at this, it is really an argument for a conscious mind. That indeed something else is there. There's more than just our brain. There is our mind. And just the fact is that we have this kind of sense of spiritual things. Ecclesiastes says that God has placed eternity in the hearts of every individual. Our atheist friends have a difficulty explaining why everybody's so religious. Well, I think we're religious because they recognize that they are made for something more than the world as well. Well, as we talk about a mind, it brings one other issue. Do we have free will or do we have full wiring? Because our atheist friends will want to say, well, every decision you make is due to your brain, so basically you're predetermined. But that doesn't work very well because in a purely physical universe, our behavior is outside of our control. And what I think he likes to point out is, you know, I've never gone into a court of law and had somebody try to argue that my defendant is innocent simply because his brain made him do it. You know, we assume that you have a free will. And one time when that case was brought all the way to the Supreme Court ruled that a deterministic view of human conduct is inconsistent with a criminal justice system. Because we assume that people make choices and that people have the freedom to choose good or to choose evil. If you think about it, the gospel is based upon that assumption that you can choose God or you can reject God. And so again, we even see this idea of free will, and that argues for something outside of the room as well. As he points it here, free to choose and create personally. So we're kind of building a profile here of this individual that, given what we know so far, the cause of the universe is external to the universe, non-spatial, atemporal, non-material, uncaused, powerful enough to create the universe, purposeful enough to produce a universe fine-tuned for life, intelligent, creative, a conscious mind, and free to choose and even create personally. We're starting to build a profile here for this suspect, which has to be outside the room because we can't explain what is inside the room. Just a couple more real quickly before we wind down today. Law and order. You know, even the most skeptical person will admit that moral truth is more than simply a matter of cultural or personal opinion. Oh yeah, we sometimes say, well, that's your opinion, it's not mine. But, you know, even a person that says all ethics are relative, steal their computer from them. And they're going to all of a sudden get all upset, you know. They say, well, you know, it doesn't matter what you do. Push them in front of a bus, you know, a little backpack. They'll act as if there is law and order. There is right and wrong. That certain things are moral and certain things are immoral. For most of us, a transcendent, objective nature of moral truth seems self-evident. And morality is more than just the survival or even majority opinion. And so again, we see that that adds one more as well, a personal source of moral truth and obligation. And so finally, we'll come to perhaps the most difficult issue. And I thought it was interesting that here, J. Warner Wallace doesn't avoid the tough issue of how do you have evil in a world where you believe in a good God. Because first of all, he points out, if you think we got a problem with evil, people that are naturalists, atheists, they've got a real problem because there is no evil. They can't say anything is evil because they don't have any objective standard for good. And so as a result, they just simply say it is. Now, there's some evolutionists that actually say, you know, there isn't right or wrong, there isn't good or evil, it just is. But most people don't live that way. And as soon as you begin to say something is evil, the standard to judge evil must come from what? Outside the room, an external source and a source of good. That transcendent objective standard of goodness is how we define what evil is. What is evil? What isn't of God? And so again, we have one more standard here as well. So you can begin to see, given what we know right now so far, the cause of the universe is external to the universe, non-spatial, atemporal, non-material, uncaused, powerful enough to create the universe, purposeful enough to produce a universe fine-tuned for life, intelligent and creative, a conscious mind free to choose and create personally, the personal source of moral truth and obligation, and the standard for good by which we define evil. Can you think of who might qualify? This is a great book to hand to a non-Christian because, interesting enough, as he goes through this, he also brings in various expert witnesses. And he brings in each chapter a non-Christian expert witness, what they say is their answer to try to explain it inside the room, and then a Christian expert witness. And I think that anybody that's at least a fair-minded person, by the time they get to the closing argument, are going to say, well, now put it in the hands of the jury. And he doesn't even necessarily make the conclusion. He simply says, look at all the things we've talked about. Starting from the upper left-hand corner, working around, we saw what? A purposeful cause for the universe. We saw as well fine-tuning for the universe. We saw intelligence and communication for the universe. We also saw design in the universe. We see a conscious mind. We also see that people are free to choose. They're not robots. We see that there's a source for moral truth and law, and there's a standard by which we can judge good and evil. And my argument would be that I think in a very, very well-written book, he's taken kind of the ideas of cold case evidence and the evidence of a detective and said, you know, look at it yourself, and this is what caused him as a secular detective doing cold cases to eventually become a Christian. He set out to disprove Christianity just like so many others, like Josh McDowell and Lee Strobel and all the rest. And here, again, is his testimony. So again, if you're interested, I can't give you a free copy of the book, but I can give you a free copy of the interview and our interview that we did. And if nothing else, it just should once again encourage you to recognize that we have evidence for our faith. And I'm glad that a detective looking at evidence have given that to us today. Parker?